All right, and welcome everyone to another Sunday afternoon here on Revolution Radio, and I'm also on PSN Radio. Thanks to Angel Espino. I was really kind of, I don't mean thanks to Angel Espino, I was really kind of, but thanks to Angel Espino, I'm on PSN Radio, comma. I should put that in there. I was fretting it as of about 5 minutes ago. I hadn't gotten contact with my guest, and I couldn't find my co-host, and they both pretty much arrived at the same time. So thank God I don't have to try to waffle on by myself until either of them showed up. But first, I want to welcome Sherry Wisdom. Hi, Sherry.
Did you come up to sweat?
Yeah, I was putting up a sweat, that's for sure.
We're here.
Well, I talked to you about, 90 minutes or so ago, and you said, oh, yeah, I'll be back in plenty of time.
And 3 minutes is plenty of time.
Yeah. First, I want to welcome also my guest, Ev Cochran. Welcome, Ev.
Thank you very much, Steve. Good afternoon, Sherry.
Hi there.
It's a privilege to be on with you, too.
This is going to be an exciting show, I think. I watched some of the videos that Stephen had sent over, so I'll be interested to have these conversations with you.
Thank you.
Yes, and Ev, I'm actually going to put your site, maverickscience.com, in the Revolution Radio chat for all to see. Do you have other sites or anything like that that you'd like to plug first off?
You know, I really don't. I think I've got some stuff up on the EU website that you're probably familiar with, but I think it's called thunderbolts.info. But other than that, no, I do not.
That's right. You are with the Thunderbolts project, aren't you?
Oh, I think I'm peripherally associated. I'm certainly good friends with Dave Talbot and Wal Thornhill. Let's put it that way.
Okay, yeah. I've had Wal Thornhill on a couple times, and interesting fellow over there. I've never actually met Dave Talbot or anything, although I'd like to get his email.
No, two really good guys. Wal's down in Australia, of course, and Dave's out in Portland. And so we have a couple meetings a year, usually at some symposium. So we got one coming up in August here.
Yes, absolutely. The Maverick Science Guy, would you like to explain what that means?
Well, it's just kind of a play on words, I guess. But in a perfect world, science on the cutting edge and science of the future. So, you know, I have quite a bit of material on there about planetary astronomy type of stuff, and I have quite a bit of material on evolutionary biology.
And what difference of a interpretation do you put forth as far as maybe mainstream science might?
Well, probably the biggest difference is we're catastrophists, and so we believe the evidence is unequivocal that the planets have moved on different orbits in the relatively recent past, so let's say within the last 6,000 years, something like that. And so most of my site will be devoted to presenting evidence from the ancient, let's say, Egyptian pyramid texts or the earliest writings from Mesopotamia describing planets on radically different orbits than they are today. And so if that thesis is correct, as we're very, very confident that it is, then a large share of modern astronomy goes out the window.
Why is there, I don't really want to get into conspiracies right now, but me and Wal Thornhill did some, but what is the conspiracy as far as mainstream science and alternative science?
Oh, I'm not sure there's any conspiracy. It's just that, you know, in any conventional scientific standpoint, whatever you want to call it, whatever discipline you're talking about, you know, they grow up being taught certain things. And when they come to power and assume their job at JPL or teaching at Harvard, you know, they're inclined to believe the stuff that they were taught growing up. And so that happens to be mainstream Darwinism. It happens to be uniformitarianism. It happens to be that the planets have always moved on their current courses for the past billions and billions of years. And I would adopt Sagan's voice as I say that. And so Sagan, of course, is probably our arch critic. And, you know, if he's right, we're wrong. But of course, we believe he's 100% wrong.
Yeah, that's funny. You should mention JPL because Sherry actually worked for JPL a long, long time ago. Didn't you, Sherry?
Well, that's very impressive because that's a great organization. Did you ever know Tim Thompson there, Sherry?
That does sound familiar. I'll be honest with you. I mean, it's been years ago. And so I'm not exactly sure. Tim Thompson, that does sound familiar to me.
Very sharp guy. And he's familiar with our theories. And but yeah.
What is a planetary catastrophe, Ev? One of your videos I caught on YouTube is Planetary Catastrophe, Ancient Myths and Modern Science.
Boy, there's so many of them up there, Steve. I don't know. I did not title that thing, so I can only assume it's a speech I gave at one of those conferences. I really do not know. But
that was EU 2015 Thunderbolts project video.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Yeah, so I'm not exactly familiar with that particular video, but I know at one of the recent conferences, one of my main arguments was looking at the North American Pawnee Indians, for example, their central creation myth that dominates their culture. They talk about a marriage between the planet Venus and the planet Mars. And so, you know, entire books have been written on that subject by mainstream astronomers, and they will argue that, you know, the Pawnee were looking at the sky and they were apparently talking about some kind of a conjunction between Mars and Venus. And so, of course, the mainstream astronomers think that has to do with the planets moving on their current orbits. And what I tried to do in that particular speech was show how the exact same idea occurs in the very earliest Sumerian text from 2000 BC, where you have the planet Venus, known as the goddess Inanna, and she participates in a sacred marriage. And I show the exact same thing in Greek myth, where Aphrodite, of course, is involved with Ares in a marriage sexual event of some sort. And in Greek myth, then, Aphrodite is the goddess of weddings, and Ares is the archetypal bridegroom, you know, in the earliest Greek text. And so you're sitting there asking yourself, why would all these cultures have talked about a grand conjunction and or a marriage of the planets Venus and Mars? And so that is essentially what that speech was about, and providing evidence for that idea.
I see. I'm familiar with with scientific evidence out there that might indicate Saturn, and I also believe it's Venus, possibly being dormant stars. I'm not sure what the specific characterization of it is. Do you have any evidence that might corroborate that?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what you're referring to, but you might be referring to Wall Thornhill's thesis that the planet Saturn was formerly a brown star.
Yes.
And that the Earth orbited very close to Saturn as like a moon of sorts. And so that idea is very prominent in our movement, and it can be traced to the ideas of Emanuel Velikovsky, who claimed something like that in the 40s, 1940s. And he really never followed that up. He intended to put that in his original book, Worlds in Collision, but it was held out at the last second so he could just focus on Venus and Mars. But this good friend of mine, Dave Talbot, kind of took that ball and started running with it in the mid-70s. And so he came out with a book called The Saturn Myth in 1980, where that thesis is defended at great length, and Dave has done more than anyone else to put forward the evidence documenting that Saturn was very prominent in the ancient consciousness.
I think that's the evidence I'm referring to. Yes, I mean there's been so many documentaries and so many interviews I've heard and seen over the years that it gets quite daunting.
Yes, no doubt.
But
and there's it's awfully difficult to separate the wheat from the chaff too. I mean, there are literally dozens of current writers that have borrowed stuff from Dave or myself and just thoroughly butchered it and put out a bunch of nonsense citing us, but having extraterrestrials build pyramids on Mars and garbage like that that we don't subscribe to at all. But I think it's important for any listeners to maybe pay attention to what Dave or Wall are saying and less so to these other guys. At least familiarize yourselves with the original proponents of these ideas.
Why do you think it is, Ev, that your scientific evidence doesn't get any sort of mention from the mainstream?
Well, it's almost like a central dogma of mainstream astronomy that the planets just cannot depart from their current courses. So if you even mention that idea or even point people towards volumes and volumes of evidence proving that to be the case, they just won't even entertain that hypothesis. So you can't even get them to, engage in debate or look at your evidence or anything else. So it really is a tough area to crack into.
Okay. Do you think it might be the echo chamber effect or?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, is it? Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I know I just mentioned the echo chamber effect, but for somebody that doesn't really know what that is without looking it up, it's the mainstream science and also the media will not entertain, as Ev just said, any other evidence because it just doesn't fit into their box or their paradigm or anything like that. But I was hoping, Sherry, I was hoping she could jump in there and help along too. I know she's studied a lot of things. She's actually studied some scientific stuff and jump on
I'm
in there, Sherry.
Thank you, Stephen. I'm very familiar with quantum and a lot of the planetary alignment and what's happening. My question is, I guess, and where I'd like to jump, if it's feasible, is Nibiru and Planet X and what you see happening with that and what the reality is for that and when it's coming and what the effects are and why the vibrational waves of the planet have moved from 7.82 to 36 in less than a month. The magnetic fields are obviously being affected dramatically.
Yeah, I'd have to just say that I'm our theories aren't involved in that stuff at all. So I would have nothing to say on that of any interest to you, I'm afraid.
That's fine. I mean, I guess that then and the only reason that I bring that up is because with the way that the planetary system and the way that they have it laid out, flat Earth, round Earth, who gives a fuck? Sorry, shit. Sorry. I just did it like three times. Sorry. More like... I warned you, Steven. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. So I guess that the substantial question that I have is that if it's true that the planetary alignment is different than what it's saying, I believe that the Earth is growing and there's all these different dynamics that are probably put into play that are not even recognized at all. What does that mean to civilization? What does that mean for the catastrophes? What do you see coming and forecast for the human race?
Well, I think the unique component of our theories is that we claim that these extraordinary catastrophic events happened in prehistory. So clearly before the pyramids were built, for example. And we also believe it was a major impetus behind the development of civilization all around the world. So our argument is the earliest civilizations were absolutely patterned after these events they were watching. And so they were, on the one hand, they were traumatized by these incredibly terrifying and dangerous events. And secondly, they were inclined or motivated to repeat these events in the sense of they repeated them in ancient rituals, in building of monuments like the pyramids and other massive monuments around the world that would model or emulate these structures that they saw in the sky. And So we're not just talking about a dry as dust astronomical theory of interest to 1 out of 1,000 people at JPL. We're talking about extraordinary catastrophic events that are behind the development of civilization and culture, and they literally impact every single aspect of culture, whether you're talking about the origin of drama, music, dance, science, et cetera, religion, certainly. And so that's kind of where we're coming from.
And how does that, in your opinion, alter the basis of the religious factor? I mean, I have my own opinions for sure. I think that I think you're right, but I'm wondering how would you break that down in a way that, you know, and when I'm hearing that, what I'm referring to or what I'm referencing is when you hear the term the Son of God, it is actually S-U-N, not S-O-N. And so when you're talking about these planetary alignments, do you think that that has more to do with it than what the actual religious factor is?
Well, our claim, of course, is that the religions themselves emulated these planetary events. And so to take a familiar example, I'm sure you're aware that in the Old Testament, all the main prophets were cautioning the Israelites not to worship the Queen of Heaven. And because that, you know, their followers were inclined to do that. And the Queen of Heaven, of course, is the planet Venus. I mean, everybody accepts that. All the mainstream biblical scholars accept that.
Right.
What they don't seem to understand is that the exact same situation happened among the Maya. The exact same situation happened among the Egyptians, the Indians of the Rig Veda period. I mean, you just go back to the earliest civilizations, they will always be preoccupied with these attitudes towards the planets. And so in ancient Israel, you know, they would do certain things for the Queen of Heaven, one of which is they would sacrifice people. And the same exact thing happened in ancient Mexico, as you know. So those earliest religions were literally astral religions. They worshiped the planets, or as you just said, they worshiped what they called the sun, S-U-N. And to some extent, that's accepted by mainstream religion, but they don't ever consider the possibility that these planets or suns were moving on different orbits and were involved in catastrophes that made them of utmost importance to the Earthlings watching them.
I'd like to hear more about that. The Earthlings watching them. Explain more about that.
Well, I mean, if these stupendous catastrophes in the sky were happening, where Venus was engaging with Mars very, very close to the planet Earth, raining down rocks on Earth, giant thunderbolts, et cetera, there would be no way for any human that was then facing that drama to escape it, either mentally or, you know, they did everything they could do to hide in a cave, needless to say, but they certainly witnessed it. So the earliest cultures of all around the world will describe those events in great detail. And so they will not only be described in their earliest myths and stories, but they'll also be fundamentally encoded in their language. And so Talbot and myself spend a great deal of time going through the early Egyptian language, the early Sumerian language, and documenting the prominence of catastrophic planetary motifs.
So where do you think that plays in today with what's happening, I guess? Are you seeing these same types of stories, I guess, as far as, I mean, let's take Nibiru out of this. We have an asteroid coming to destroy the planet once again. All of the different, you know, as soon as Venus comes into play, a lot of times you'll see a lot of different alignments in the sky because it lights up in a different area, and you'll see it for long periods of time and then it goes away. I mean, how do you think, and now it's back, and we've got all of these things. What it was just recently that we had all of the planets in perfect alignment and none of them in retro. Like, that hasn't happened for like 333,000 years. So, yeah, go. What is that? What's that mean for us today?
Well, I don't think any of those things mean anything today, to be perfectly frank with you. But to give you an example of a recent event that I'm sure you heard about, within the last two decades, that comet Shoemaker-Levy crashed into Jupiter. I'm not sure if you remember that, but astronomers at JPL and elsewhere were watching as this comet approached Jupiter, and it suddenly fragmented into roughly, I think I remember it being 21 different pieces, and those pieces kind of came to form a line as they approached Jupiter. They were described as pearls on a string, and then they just plummeted into Jupiter. Now, obviously, Jupiter is a massive object, and it, you know, didn't suffer terribly from that event. But if that comet was plowing into New York City, obviously the catastrophic effects would be enormous. And so I think as astronomers have become more skilled with their telescopes, it's become much, much more obvious that, as you said in your first sentence, that there are asteroids on uncertain orbits, and they certainly can approach the Earth and cause great harm. And so I remember an article from 1999, also an astronomer from Houston, a lady said, "One thing is for certain, the idea that planets can change their orbits dramatically is here to stay." And that is exactly what we believe. But unfortunately, I've never heard any serious astronomer other than this lady ever mention that in public before. Her name was Malhotra. And so anyway, it's slow to gain currency among conventional scientists, but as they keep their telescopes peeled to the neighboring solar systems and they see Jupiter-sized objects rotating around suns at very, very close distances, and they see all these Shoemaker-like comets plowing into other planets, the ideas are going to get out there that catastrophism is a real thing, especially since we have abundant human testimony that actually occurred on Earth.
Did you have something else, Sherry?
Yeah, I did. I'm sorry. I'm sitting here kind of, I'm contemplating the questions. I have a few questions that I want to ask you, but I think I want to go back to with the planetary, with these types of things happening outside of planetary system, where do you and how do you answer when people start asking you if the Earth is flat or round?
Well, I mean, it's pretty simple. We've been up to the planet Moon, and we've taken pictures from there, and the Earth shows up as a round object from situations like that, and or from the satellites we've got rotating around the Earth. So it's a pretty safe assumption that the Earth is round. That would be my answer. I mean, that seems fairly obvious.
I personally, right. I don't, I'm not going to go into the flat Earth thing, you know. I'm just not going to do it. I just don't care for it. I think it's just a distraction.
That would be my assessment as well. I mean, it's just anti-scientific. We're all about taking the latest results of modern science and trying to make sense of the earliest written texts by cultures all around the world and seeing if they, if the two synchronize or explain each other. In our opinion, they do, but mainstream astronomers, of course, don't give a hoot about ancient myths or the pyramid text, and so they don't pay any attention to the stories in there, and they certainly wouldn't give them any credence if they did know anything about them.
Right. I wanted to go into maybe a direction. One of the videos I caught, Ev, you were quoting from another researcher from the past of the ancient Sumerian text. It almost seemed like a romance novel read as far as the ancient texts talked about sex with, I don't know, just talked about romantic things, sex with humans or whatever.
Yeah, I think you're probably talking about the Sumerian sacred marriage texts, which stem from about 2000 BC. And yes, those are heavily referenced in various speeches of mine. And basically, they describe the central leading religious ritual that the Sumerians practiced at that time. And it involved the king emulating a planetary power and having sexual intercourse with the planet Venus. So he will, you know, those texts themselves describe the king making love with this goddess called Inanna, and they specifically identify Inanna with the planet Venus and say she, you know, appeared in the sky. And
so that's not a metaphor?
No. Well, it's a metaphor in the sense that the king didn't literally jump up and have intercourse with the planet Venus. The king is emulating or personifying the planet Mars in that situation. So the Sumerian king is doing exactly what the Greek writers said Ares did with Aphrodite, and what the Pawnee said that the planet Mars did with their queen of heaven, the planet Venus. And so in that particular presentation, I was just saying these three totally separate cultures that have nothing whatsoever in common and certainly didn't share their religious belief systems amongst each other. They all describe the exact same story.
Why do you
go ahead.
Why do you think ancient man worshipped things in the sky, the sun, the moon, Venus, Saturn?
Well, not only because they dominated the sky. Again, you got to understand they were way, way closer. You know, so Venus and Saturn and Mars were massive in the sky during this prehistoric period. So they were bigger than our current sun or moon. And so they were dominant, number one. Number two, they were absolutely terrifying, you know, throwing down massive thunderbolts and, you know, engaging in what you would call erratic behavior. So they were literally the gods. And so if you look at, just take the earliest language that you and I speak, Indo-European, and you know, English goes back to Latin and it goes back to what you'd call Indo-European language. So the original words for God will be stuff like, will be a name like Zeus, right?
Uh-huh, okay.
And Zeus in all those languages, ancient Latin, ancient Indian, as in the Rig Veda from India, it will always mean a celestial object, number one, and it will mean something that throws down lightning or thunder, number two. So you have these, the much, much later Greek statues of Zeus throwing down thunderbolts, of course. So there's no doubt whatsoever, just from the evidence of language itself, that the earliest gods were celestial bodies, and they were causing these major events like these massive thunderbolts to happen. And what's true in the Indo-European language is also true of the Sumerian language. Take whichever language you want, you're going to find the exact same correlations.
I was wondering also, unless Sherry jumps in there quickly, I'm not really sure what the actual premise of the Thunderbolts project is. I asked Ev, but I mean, you know, I asked Wall Thornhill, but I'd like to get your interpretation.
Well, Wall is certainly much more versed in that than I am. But again, the idea goes back to Velikovsky. I think the best way to visualize it is he obviously claimed that great thunderbolts were exchanged between these planets moving very, very close to the Earth. And so Wall has spent a great deal of time presenting unbelievably compelling evidence that these massive thunderbolts have carved out the face of the planet Mars, for example. And so mainstream conventional astronomy would have you believe that Mars has been exactly where it is today for countless billions of years. And every now and then a meteor will plunk down there and create a pockmark on the planet Mars. That's the mainstream theory. Whereas Wall's theory is that these massive catastrophic events on the planet Mars that are totally visible if you look at the planet Mars, they happened in very recent times, and they are electrically induced from massive thunderbolts. So they immediately carved out that massive canyon up there, for example, or they caused massive volcanoes. Of course, Mars has the biggest volcanoes in the solar system. And the whole surface of Mars was literally resurfaced overnight, basically.
Well,
and so we know now, when we first started this in the 80s and 90s, we were always arguing that Mars was very close to the Earth and that Mars and Earth exchange material. And it was only in about 1994 that it became discovered that literally rocks from the planet Mars are found on the Earth, the so-called meteorites. And so, you know, that makes perfect sense from our theory, where Mars was very close to the Earth and these massive catastrophes were happening, re-sculpting the face of Mars and sending out all of this giant boulders and debris into the sky. It only follows that some of that debris would fall onto the planet Earth.
Well, I have a friend. He's over there in Ireland. He's been following you guys at the Thunderbolts project for many, many years, probably as many years as you guys have been together. But he has an idea he's put forth that the mountain ranges all over the Earth are not what mainstream science says they are. He's of the idea that they could be arcs from planetary strikes, like the Thunderbolt strikes that come from the other planets when they get too close to each other. Or if there was ancient history, there was stories of these planetary strikes. And he's of the idea that they could be the physical results of these strikes.
I think Wall would agree with that. So I think there's much to be said for that idea. I'm not as familiar with that side of Earth geology as I am with Mars geology, for example. But certainly it would make sense.
But there are physical. Do you think the physical, well, I think you already said it already, that you do think the physical results of the strikes on Mars are from planetary strikes, correct?
Oh, absolutely. They're interplanetary thunderbolts. And so as Mars moves very close to the Earth, it suffered massive thunderbolts. Same with when Mars approached the planet Venus. Both planets were substantially altered. And, you know, that's why Mars looks the way it looks today. It was buffeted about. It's obviously a lot smaller than the Earth or Venus. So it suffered the brunt of the disasters.
Yeah. I'll have to pass you that video after the show here. So I don't know, maybe you can look at it.
No, that'd be very interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, certainly. Sherry, you want to jump in there again?
I'm just kind of listening. You know, I have very... my theories and my ideas of things are very out there. And so, although I agree with most of what you're saying, 100%, as far as religion and different things, as far as the planetary basis, as far as Mars, all of that,
Do you think your ideas go a little further? Is that what you're trying?
Yeah. I think I've jumped about 10 steps forward. Not in a negative way towards you in any aspect. I just...
I understand.
Yeah, because the thing is that when I started learning quantum physics at about 8 or 9, I could see then that what we were being told about the planetary system was not accurate. So I'm now, you know, in my 40s, and so I've been studying this and watching it for a lot of years. And I believe you're absolutely right. That's why I said the Son of God, right, is actually S-U-N, and it breaks down all the planets. It breaks down into all the quantum. It breaks down into all the physical matter of the body. And so that's where, like I said, I think I take it into just another dimensional side as far as like what quantum brings in, because I also believe that within our bodies, every organ, different organ, vibrates as the planets do. So not only when you're saying the words as above is below, it's literal. And so the whole dynamic of the planetary system being the dynamic of our universe is not outside of any form of reality. And anyway, that was probably a little further than I wanted to jump. But yes, I agree with you. I just think that I'm probably not the one to be asking a bunch of questions right now.
I appreciate that, Sherry. Thanks for sharing that with us. Interesting stuff.
Well,
It is fascinating to me. Sorry, Stephen, go ahead.
No, go right on ahead.
It is fascinating to me because I think that part of, if people start studying the different religious materials, not necessarily the religion, but the materials themselves, they do start seeing the correlation that you're talking about. And then on top of it, when you start talking about Venus and you start talking about Jupiter and you start talking about these vibrations, I think a lot of people are familiar with, you know, Venus is the vibration of love. You've got Saturn, which is the sexual vibrations. You've got Jupiter, which is the mind and all of these different things. And so I guess the only question that I might have is, what is your theory about the rings around Saturn? Do you have a theory on that? Is that something that you guys talk about? Because I think at one time it was thought to be of physical matter, particle matter. And now it's at one point they have discovered that it's actually vibrational. It's vibrational, enough mass vibrationally that it actually causes it to be visual.
Well, I'm not an expert on Saturn's rings, let's put it that way. But I think our theory basically holds that they are of recent formation. So they haven't been there for billions and billions of years. That would be the first important statement. The second important statement would be they are definitely physical in nature. I mean, we've sent space probes up there that show the rings to be composed of little moonlets and dust and that type of stuff. They're ethereal in structure, but they are very definitely physical structures. And these little moons kind of shepherd the debris around Saturn. So it's a much more complex structure than was envisioned 30 years ago before the planetary probes went up there and actually filmed that stuff. So that's about all I would say on it, because I'm not an astronomer, but I think that's essentially the current position.
Are you still there, Sherry?
I'm here.
Sometimes she talks and she doesn't know she's muted.
I am sorry.
And sometimes she talks before you can mute her, right?
Today, I'm just off today. I'm sorry that you have to deal with me. Normally, I would not be this completely chaotic. Well, anyway, I apologize.
My friends in the catastrophist movement will know that I'm not one to shy away from some rough language every now and then. So let's just put it that way. So I'm certainly not bothered by anything you've said. Let's put it that way.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. And I know that sometimes my questioning can also be extremely out there. Like I said, I mean, when you are focused in one area in the science realm or anything, I think that is what you become an expert in. And with doing radio the way that Stephen and I do and being exposed to the things we are, we get to jump into every rabbit hole that there is.
Right.
And that makes us crazier and also, you know, maybe gives us a wider spectrum. You know, that's all it is. Yeah.
Yeah. A more expansive vision than specialists like myself might have. So I certainly can understand that and even to some extent agree with it.
I wanted to explore more of Velikovsky. I've never really looked into his research or his work or anything.
Goodness. Well, as it turns out, Stephen, I'm actually writing a book on the subject right now, and I was hoping to have it done by August in time for our conference in Phoenix. But it doesn't look like it's going to quite get done. But in any case, yeah, I know about as much about the subject as anybody.
Okay. So what was his main premise?
Well, probably the most exciting part of the story was he was a student of Freud's that came to America in 1939. He was a psychoanalyst. At that time, he was living in Israel, and he came to the United States to pursue a book, and that book became Worlds in Collision. It was published in 1950, and it was an instant bestseller. It just was rocketing off the shelves and was getting a ton of publicity in all the papers. Everybody wanted to read it, and the Harvard and basically the idea there was he claimed that the planet Venus only recently presented a comet-like appearance and caused disasters on the planet Earth and around the solar system. And once the Harvard astronomers heard about that, and they actually heard about it before the book was even published, because a bunch of book reviews appeared in the New York Times and elsewhere, Harper's and Collier's and those kind of magazines. Once they heard about it, the top astronomer, the Carl Sagan of the time, named Harlow Shapley, led an organized boycott of the publisher, which was Macmillan, and forced Macmillan to drop the book, even though it was a runaway bestseller. So that is what that set of events in 1950s, what came to be known as the Velikovsky Affair, where you have an organized campaign on the behalf of astronomers to silence and suppress researchers' ideas. And so that is who Velikovsky was. And we are, Talbot rose to a measure of fame in the mid-70s by publishing a journal that reopened that question. It was called Ponce. It was first published in May of 72, and it was also unbelievably successful. And it ultimately led to a astronomers sanctioned debate between Carl Sagan and Velikovsky in San Francisco of 1974.
Wow.
And so that's, in a nutshell, that's what the controversy is all about. And so Dave and myself have, while we're not Velikovskians, you know, we don't believe in him any more than we believe in Einstein or Darwin or anybody else. I mean, we like to take the best of Einstein, the best of Darwin, the best of Velikovsky, and move forward. But we are catastrophists like Velikovsky, and there aren't many of us out there. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. How does a psychologist get into that type of a field or that type of research?
Oh, it's a long story, but Freud's last book was called Moses and Monotheism. It was also published in 1939, and it just kind of made Velikovsky mad. And so he started doing research trying to reconstruct the history of ancient Egypt. And while doing that, he stumbled across the idea that the planets have not always been in their current orbits. And so that's why he was driven to publish Worlds in Collision. He published quite a few books, actually, but that's certainly the most famous one. And so anyway, like I say, if you're familiar with Dave's work, that's how Dave got started in 72, publishing that journal. And he was very, very much interested in Velikovsky. So he followed his Saturn material and wrote his own book called The Saturn Myth. And then he's written, a ton of stuff since then. Wal Thornhill did the exact same thing. He met Velikovsky in the mid-70s. One of Velikovsky's key ideas was that electricity permeates the universe and is behind some of these motions of the planets, and certainly is behind these massive thunderbolts hurled by the planets. And so Wall, since the mid-70s, has focused his research primarily on the electricity, the electric component of the universe, that type of stuff.
Yes.
So he's more in the physical area, whereas Dave and I are more in the myth and ancient religion and language and literature type of area.
Well, I'm not willing to discount anyone's evidence or anyone's research. I've found, someone pointing a finger at you and calling you silly or something like that is nothing but a ad hominem attack, nothing but a straw man attack. And I'm just not willing to do that. I'm also not willing to take mainstream's word as gospel either.
I hear you there, man. Believe me, you wouldn't be the first to call us silly, but
right, right.
That goes without saying. But we're very happily surprised that the recent space probes seem to be confirming again and again our viewpoint of the solar system and its recent history. So we think the evidence is moving in our direction. So we're very confident about the future.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've actually only got about four minutes until the break. Go ahead, Jerry.
I have one quick question that was in the chat. And so if we can answer it quickly, if it's too much, then we'll have to wait to another time. But Gary was asking in the chat what your thought or theory on the Big Bang Theory.
That it never happened and it's complete fantasy.
Ah, okay.
That's
yeah, it's kind of like Eric Lerner's book called The Big Bang Never Happened. So I think that's Wall would endorse that opinion.
Well, that's what I've been hearing from a lot of people, actually. Do you know a man named David Yurth over there in Utah?
No.
No? Well, he's pretty much shunned, put to the underground, and has to, you know, he's criticized by the mainstream, and he's been squelched by the mainstream, and I've had him on a few times. I need to get back in contact with him again. I haven't talked to him in like a year and a half because he's been drug around like a bad habit. But he says a lot of the same things. He says it's a lot of the mainstream science is nothing but junk science.
Well, obviously, to use JPL as an example, once again, there's some phenomenal scientists there doing fantastic work, whether you're talking about sending the probes by all the various planets and looking at Saturn's rings and the surface of Mars. So they're doing phenomenal research, and they're certainly helping us make our case.
Yeah.
So I would never disparage modern science, but it is unfortunate that they are so deeply entrenched in old-fashioned ideas. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you have something else, Sherry?
No.
Okay. We still have time for a couple more F-bombs, Sherry, if you want to.
I know. Really, like, I put the sign, actually, I make a sign for this particular show, and I put it up about the cussing, because I do a couple of other shows that, well, I'm not, I don't, I cuss.
They let you do what you want to do, yeah.
Well, hey, you two, I really appreciate the chance to chat with you guys. It's been very nice to meet you, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, you're very welcome.
Hopefully we'll see you out at one of our events one of these days, Stephen, and we'll have a chance to do this again.
Where's that going to be at? Your next one?
Phoenix, August 17th, I believe.
Okay. I can actually plan for that because Sherry's out in Denver, and I'm going out there here pretty soon, and I can go out there just about whenever I want to.
You would love it. There's going to be a lot of excitement out there for sure.
Yeah,
no doubt about it.
I'd like to meet David and, well, everybody, the whole gang or whatever.
Yeah, we're going to have a lot of guest speakers that you will be interested in, and it's going to be a heck of an event, no doubt about it.
I've heard so much about David Talbot. You know, I've gotten in. Well, I'd like to finish that, but I can't. There's the music, everyone. So we'll be right back in about 7 minutes. Thanks again, Ev.